A programming note for you, the following topical currents is a rebroadcast. We won't be taking any phone calls or emails or tweets. Also, it features hosts Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper has been out recovering from a severe back injury, and he appreciates your well wishes, and he's doing much better. But again, this is a rebroadcast of Topical Currents.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with colleague Bonnie Berman. How are you this afternoon, Bonnie?
I'm good, and how are you?
Well, I'm fine. Today we get a reality check about family finance and responsibility. We'll visit with Steve and Annette Economidis, who don't mind the term about them being called America's cheapest family. Their latest book is The Money Smart Family System, Teaching Financial Independence to Children of Every Age, and they join us from Scottsdale, Arizona. Welcome to you, Steve and Annette.
Well, hi there, Joe and Bonnie. How are you?
It's great to be here.
We're doing very well. When should financial education begin for kids?
Well, we started our kids when they were about 3 years old.
At
3 years old, all they were doing was identifying, learning to identify and count coins. And then when they were between like 5 and 8, they started with a three-part piggy bank, which we have on our website at americascheapestfamily.com. And then when they're 8 to about 16, they have envelopes.
Cash envelopes.
And we have a special Money Smart Kid system with that in there.
And it's described in the book, The Money Smart Family System. But the whole point is that we're not just teaching them about money. The whole point of the Money Smart Family System is it's not just money. It's teaching them to work, to earn, to save, and to spend wisely.
Why did you turn your focus in this book to the subject of kids and money?
Because if parents aren't careful, according to the USDA, they will spend somewhere a little over $250,000 raising one child from the age of 0 to 17. Now, that's a lot of money. In our second book, we wrote a book called Cut Your Grocery Bill in Half, and we told families we could save them $3,000. But saving $200,000 is a huge amount of money at risk. And we're not talking about not paying for things for your kids. What we are saying is we're finding ways to take the money we're going to spend on our children and actually turning it into an investment in them to teach them to stand financially independent over time. So we start with a little bit of money when they're young, teach them to manage that. They're given the money to spend and to take care of. And as they're faithful with that, we give them a little more and a little more till the time they're 16 and they get a part-time job. They are pretty much self-sufficient, either living in our house, but they're paying for all of their toys, games, recreational activities.
Clothes.
Why do you think it's so important for kids to become financially independent?
That's a great question, Bonnie. You know, one of the gals that endorsed our book, Glinda Bridgeforth, who was an Oprah Debt Diet coach, said that today 60% of all adult children are being supported by their parents.
And we have to realize that we aren't raising children. We are raising future adults. And future adults need to be able to stand independent. And if we don't teach them to be financially responsible as parents, we will end up supporting them for the rest of their lives. And we can tell you story after story of people who are in their 50s that we know of that are still, they have a lifeline to their parents. The parents are in their 70s, and the parents are supporting these adult children. And it just shouldn't be that way.
With your kids, though, I suppose you strike some balance. You're firm and you stress financial sense, but you also aren't the great Santini, are you?
Well, you know, our kids are awesome. They want to pay for, like Steve said, all their recreational expenses. You know, if they're in their teen years and they're going through a growth spurt and they run out of money in their clothing envelope, for heaven's sakes, we're going to help them buy a pair of shoes and some underwear. But it's not going to be $150 sneakers. It's going to be $30 or $40 sneakers.
And our goal is to help them stand on their own. Now, we've heard something in our house that probably less than 1% of parents have ever heard. And that was when our son Joe, who's now 20, he's got 3 semesters left in college, he came to us his freshman year and he said, "Mom and Dad, I don't want you to pay anything for my college education. I want to do this on my own."
Mm.
He has done it without loans. And it's not been easy for him. But the struggle he's going through is building a financial strength and resilience in him that will help him conquer huge tasks in the future.
And he takes his studies so seriously. He's in study groups. He's got a 3.8 GPA. I mean, he is working really hard.
So how did he do that? Through work and scholarships or just working?
Well, that's one of the biggest chapters in this book, The Money Smart Family System, because college is a huge expense. And the USDA, when they say it's going to cost $261,000, doesn't even include college, which I think is a ripoff to parents. But we help our kids learn by creating an atmosphere in our house that education is important. We read books. We do more reading of books than we do watching of television. We still watch some TV, but reading is important, and our kids learn that at a young age. They learn that as they get good grades in high school, that translates into money for college. And all of our kids have gone to college. We have 5 kids, and not one of them has taken out a loan.
And all of our kids have learned to work really hard. They have a real solid work ethic. And we have a whole chapter in our book on chores and how those can also be a tool to help your kids learn not only working but earning. And so each of our kids has had no problem having a part-time job. And as a matter of fact, all of their bosses have wanted to promote them to management, and they haven't been able to be in management while they've been in school because they only wanted to work part-time and they wanted to do well in their classes.
There's a philosophy out there that says, you know, our kids' job is to go to school and that's their most important job. But we cited some surveys in the book that gave hard statistics on the fact that a kid can work between 15 and 20 hours a week, and those kids that did that, on average, had better grade point averages than the kids who didn't and the kids who worked more than that. So we don't think that juggling 2 responsibilities or 3, if you include family, harms a kid. It actually is real life. We're preparing them for adulthood. And in adulthood, you don't just go to work and that's your only responsibility.
Right. You don't get to just juggle one ball. All of us have myriads of balls that we're juggling.
That's true.
Steve and Annette, did either or both of you have this kind of upbringing when you were young?
You know, we didn't. Not at all.
We grew up in similar households where our parents were frugal. Both of our parents shopped at JCPenney Catalog Outlet. But that was about it. They never went to garage sales. They didn't have any of the black belt skills that we had, although both of our moms cooked at home.
Yes.
Okay. But we've taken it even further, and the reason we did was really out of necessity, because when we were first married in 1982, I was earning $6.50 as a paste-up artist at a printing company. I had a degree in graphic design and advertising, and Annette wanted to stay home and learn how to manage our home, which we thought was important. So we lived on one income. We were told to live on 3 incomes. I was supposed to work 2 jobs. Annette was supposed to work 1 job, and we were supposed to save every penny we earned, and we were supposed to buy a house in 3 years. Well, we worked 1 job. Annette stayed home. We saved our money, and within 3 years, we had 15% to put down. We bought a house, and we paid it off in 9 years on a one-income household. So it can be done, and it's learning to manage and learning to be money smart.
Well, I'm going to ask you in a minute what it means to be money smart, but first, let's invite our audience in. We're visiting with Steve and Annette Economidis, and they've written The Money Smart Family System, Teaching Financial Independence to Children of Every Age. What tips do you have for instilling financial responsibility for kids, and how do you fight the urge to indulge? That's our question for you. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the number to call is 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN, or you can email radio@WLRN.org. That's radio@WLRN.org.
Steve and Annette, what would have happened if one of your kids turned out to be the renegade and be rebellious against your system? How would you have handled that?
Well, we had that. Not all of our kids really wholeheartedly accepted it. As they got older, we allowed for their independence because every child is different. So our oldest son bought his first car for cash when he was 17 years old. He saved for a year and saved $6,000. that car got damaged in an accident. He bought another car for cash, and he bought a third car for cash, and he got that one got stolen.
But he had a friend whispering in his ear the whole time, you need to have credit, you need to establish credit.
And
you need
he was about 21 years old at this
point. And so he came to us, he said, Mom and Dad, will you co-sign for a loan? I want to buy a new truck. And we said, John, you know we can't do that. We just, co-signing we aren't comfortable with. We'll buy the car for you and you can pay us, but we just don't believe in co-signing. He said, well, that doesn't accomplish what I want to accomplish. I want to establish credit. So we were like, okay, go ahead. So he went, he bought a truck, and like 3 years later he came back to us and said, that was the stupidest thing I ever did.
Because he had to get a loan, which is a great experience for him. He had to go through the process of filling out loan documents, getting turned down, finally finding somebody who'd loan him $21,000 at 16% interest, and he learned the lesson of paying that. And then he met a girl. Rachel is the sweetest girl. He married her, but he wouldn't marry her until he paid off his car. So then he had to learn how to accelerate payments. See, we don't want to protect our kids from reality.
Right.
The lessons he learned, he could never have learned if we had been this indulged him or bought the car and given it to him. Those are great life lessons he'll never forget.
And we don't want to shove our principles and our convictions down their throat. We want to equip them with tools to put them in a better position in life. So just like the Amish let their kids go, like the last 2 years or something, and I think 80% of them return back to the Amish community, we've got to do the same. So we're giving them the tools, but as they get older, they get more and more decision-making power, and eventually they're sailing on their own.
We're speaking with Steve and Annette Economidis. We're talking about their book, Money Smart Family System, Teaching Financial Independence to Children of Every Age. Steve and Annette, stay with us. We're going to take a short break and be back with more.
Okay.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents for this Tuesday. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with Steve and Annette Economidis, who wrote the book, The Money Smart Family System, Teaching Financial Independence to Children of Every Age. So why don't we go to the basics? Let's talk about the 5, 50, 500 money rule and why it's so important, Annette and Steve.
Okay.
Well, Bonnie, that rule, if parents are unaware of it, will end up costing them $200,000. And here's how, this is something we discovered, I discovered in the printing industry, and I related it to us. And basically, it's the ever-increasing cost of an unlearned lesson. And the parents are going to bear the cost on this one. And here's how it works. Between the ages of 0 and 5, when your child wants something, whether it's a toy, a pair of shoes, a little cute dress, something at the checkout lane, that item is going to cost you $5 unless you find a way to allow the child to have some influence and purchase power in that decision. So in other words, you say, yeah, I know you'd like that package of gum, but you have to do these chores first before we'll ever buy that. You know, and you give them the ability to earn it. So $5. Every time you give in, you teach the child that mom and dad will pay that $5. And most parents could afford that. The problem is with the 5-50-500 rule, the cost escalates. And here's how it goes. Between 0 and 5, it's $5. Between 6 and 11, it goes to $50. Between 12 and 17, it goes to $500. That's the new cell phone. That's the iPad. That's maybe some of those LeBron James gym shoes. Well, those are pretty expensive.
Right.
Between 18 and 24, when they had college years, it's $5,000. And a lot of parents, you know, the kid gets a credit card, and they haven't been prepared to use it, and that credit card bill comes home, and the parents pay the $5,000 credit card bill, or the wrecked car, or the semester or two or three of school. What really kills parents' retirement is 24 and above. And if we haven't taught our kids to stand financially independent, the 5-50-500 rule escalates to $50,000. And that's the divorce, the mortgage, home foreclosure, car repossession, all kinds of expensive problems. So that's why we want to inoculate our kids and empower parents to avoid the 550-500 rule by raising money smart kids who know how to stand financially on their own.
Okay, so how does this point system work with the chores, and how early are they supposed to begin doing chores? You say 3 years old?
Absolutely, and of course they're all age appropriate, and in the chore chapter of our book we have lists and lists of age appropriate chores. So at 3 years old, it may be collecting the waste baskets to be emptied. It may be dragging the laundry basket to the washer. It may be emptying just the silverware basket from the dishwasher. We had our kids standing on a chair in front of the silverware drawer with the silverware basket in front of them, and they could look and figure out which one were the little spoons and the big spoons and the little forks and the big forks. And so we started them real little, and we had plates, Corral, that were virtually unbreakable because we knew things were going to get dropped. We never got upset about dropped or broken stuff because the kids were learning to help us and learning to be productive. So chores are an excellent way. The points are, so there's 4 points a day. There's the morning point, which is get dressed, take care of your personal hygiene, make your bed, eat breakfast with a cheerful attitude, because everybody's favorite, you know, with five kids in the house, we were sure to be cooking somebody's favorite one day and somebody's least favorite that same day. And so that was important. Attitude was one of those important things we wanted to emphasize. Point number two was chores, and we talked about that, age-appropriate. Point number three was schoolwork. Make sure your schoolwork is done with a good effort, not just the minimal effort, but a good effort. And so each kid functions at their own ability. If you had one kid that pulled all A's but never cracked a book, and then you had another kid that studied like crazy and got B's, that's okay. Obviously, you want to encourage that A student who never has to crack a book to keep doing their best, but you have to allow for different kids and different abilities. And then the final one was Roundup. And because we live out west with towns like Two Guns and Tombstone, we decided to pick that western flair. We named it Roundup. And it's where you go through the house before dessert each night and pick up your stuff. Because with seven people living in the house, if three items were left out every day, that would quickly add up to over 100 items by the end of the week.
So the kids could earn 4 points a day, 5 days a week. That came out to 20 points. On Saturday, they didn't have school, so that was an additional 3 points they could earn. If they found two additional things to do around the house without us telling them, and they came to us and said, you know, I saw that the lawn needed to be mowed, or I saw that this stuff needed to be picked up, or whatever, we'd give them an extra point. If they got 25 points during the week, they would get double pay. We wanted to have an incentive system where they could get a bonus, because that's real life.
Right.
So 25 points a week got them double pay, and at the age of 5 to 7, they earned about $2.50 a week. They didn't have the mental capacity to handle hundreds of dollars, so $2.50 worked out. And it's a sliding scale. Parents can change it. You just have to be sure that you can afford it. And at the maximum, it cost us about $520 a year, $10 a week, for our kids up to the age of 16. But with that money, they were putting money into give to charities, save for college. They put 20% in that, spend. And then at age 11, they started buying their own clothes. We wanted a reality aspect of their spending. And eventually they bought their own Christmas presents for their siblings and relatives and paid for camp fees, sports fees, all that stuff. We gave them a little more money, and they managed it.
I suppose, as in every family, though, it's inevitable there'd be sibling rivalries. How did you handle those?
You know, we didn't have a whole lot of sibling rivalry because we spent so much time working together, accomplishing things, teaching our kids to enjoy what they needed to do and how they would feel when they got it done.
And they bought their own stuff.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh, gosh, you know, you gave John this fancy new toy and I want one of those. Well, no, if you want to buy that new toy, save your money, you can buy it.
And they all had private spots for their stuff. And since they paid for it, you know, we taught our kids to respect each other. And you don't just, you know, run off and grab Sally's toy. You play with your own toys.
But we also used a kitchen timer at times. When we have a nativity set in our front hall that every Christmas the kids wanted to rearrange when they were younger. And so Annette would allow them a certain amount of time each day, or she'd say, okay, today is Roy's day, tomorrow is Joe's day, then Abby gets Thursday, and they'd have a day. So we we work through little systems to allow them to feel special, but also to allow everybody to have their own time.
Or to cooperate with each other.
So how do you get, or how do you teach kids to spend their money responsibly from an early age? That sounds like kind of a tall order.
Because actually, it's not as hard as you think, Bonnie, because we did a lot of garage sales, and when a little five-year-old comes up with their purse and all their coins, and they want to buy costume jewelry or a board game or a stuffed animal, and they have their own money, and we taught our kids to negotiate even at 5 years old, people are so delighted and enamored, it's like they bend over backwards to give our kids stuff.
But when they got older and their wants got bigger and their expenses got larger,
right.
We tell a story in the book where Roy, who was about 14 years old at the time, had saved $60 or $70 to buy a Kinex Screaming Serpent roller coaster. Now, he built with Kinex for years. It's a great little toy, building system. And he saw this roller coaster and thought he wanted it, and we knew that it probably wouldn't satisfy him. But he kept coming at us wanting to buy it, and since he'd saved his money, we relented. I said, okay, you've done the research, you found a good deal, you can buy it. He spent 2 days putting it together, played with it for a few hours, and walked away from it. Left it for a few days, came back, watched the roller coaster go around and around and around a couple times, and then realized that this was boring.
So did he make a mistake?
He did, but it was a $60 mistake, and the story goes on because then he decided he wanted to get his money back.
Oh.
So he tried to sell it at a garage sale. Then he learned the lesson of depreciation. What an awesome lesson. We could have told him, no, you'll never like that, you aren't going to buy it, and he would have resented that. Instead, he purchased it with his own money, he saved for it, he had to forego other purchases, and he learned that it took him a year to sell it for $30. He got 50% depreciation on it. He will never forget that.
Perhaps I read the book, I didn't read this correctly, but you talk about having the kids pay for their personal items such as cosmetics and that, but did you also include the braces? Isn't that
that's in the miscellaneous chapter, and
right.
We went to our Facebook fans and said, what things do you think parents should pay for, and what shouldn't they pay for?
Right.
And so in that chapter, we listed braces, and we said, parents should pay for this if they can afford it without going into debt, but it shouldn't be done only if it's purely cosmetic. You have to really evaluate stuff, because debt is teaching, going into debt for cosmetic issues is teaching your kids that if you don't have the money, it's okay just to go spend it frivolously.
I mean, if your kids really do need the braces, then we're saying liquidate some assets to pay for them. And so we went through all things from school supplies, and we talked about school pictures. We're saying live within your means. So if you don't have lots of discretionary funds, but you want your child to have a school picture, then just buy one classroom picture and one 5x7 of your child. You don't need to buy the whole package.
And if your son or daughter wants to, when they graduate from high school, they want to buy a class ring, by all means, parents should allow the child to participate in the purchase of that. And let them put up some of their money. They're old enough.
How many people have class rings sitting in a box somewhere in the closet?
Well, probably quite
worn.
A few.
Yeah, they aren't worn. So and then they get sold to scrap dealers.
Yeah, once you're in college, you don't want to be caught dead wearing your high school.
Exactly. Right.
Parents are not obligated to fund every child's wants.
So under the personal items, we talk about things like haircuts and how we learned to give haircuts here. We talk about cosmetics and how for cosmetics they were basically used as gifts for Christmas or birthdays. If the girls wanted them at another time, then they paid the money. They saved their money and they paid for them. Same thing with, we're going to supply soap and shampoo, but if they want a specialty thing, say they want a special shampoo that's $10 a bottle, well, our budget's $3 a bottle or less. So if they want that, then they have to make up the difference.
So you'll give them the Prell, but not the other stuff.
Yeah. Here's the end game. If we live within our means, and let's say we're an average family earning a household income of $50,000 to $70,000 a year, and we teach our children to live on that money. In other words, we buy them the things we can afford and give it to them. We have locked them into having to live at that lifestyle. When they graduate from school, or if they don't go to college and they just get a job, they are not going to be at that earning level. But if we've indulged them and paid for everything, they will be at that spending level.
Right.
And we have handcuffed them to our lifestyle. Isn't it better to teach them to live within their means of $10 a week, or if they get a part-time job, $70 a week, to pay for their own auto insurance, to pay for their own clothes, so that as they get more and more income, they can expand that lifestyle without debt? See, we haven't raised their expectations. If they happen to hit a home run and they become a Major League Baseball player, or they become an executive at a company and they earn lots of money, have we harmed them at all by teaching them to live within their means or below their means?
I guess not.
I don't think so.
No.
I think we've actually empowered them.
Right.
To be able to be generous and support their local NPR station.
Exactly. We were wondering. Just that. If you're, that's what Joe and I mentioned. We wondered if your kids support their local NPR station.
Our kids give to so many charities. And you know, the cool thing is, when they were younger, Abby read a book about a woman who was giving wheelchairs away to kids and handicapped children in foreign countries. And she took, I think it was a dollar or two, and she wanted to send it to Johnny and Friends.
Wow.
What an awesome thing for a little kid to do.
I wanted to ask you about the charitable giving. We need to take another short break. Why don't you just stay with us, and we'll get back to that when we return.
Okay,
we're speaking with Steve and Annette Economides. The name of their book, The Money Smart Family System, Teaching Financial Independence to Children of Every Age. On today's Topical Currents, we'll be right back.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, and we're speaking with Steve and Annette Economides. We're talking about their book, The Money Smart Family System. If you'd like to join in, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email is radio@WLRN.org. And Bonnie, you want to discuss charitable giving?
Yes, I was wondering how giving to others and the charitable giving enters into the money smart equation.
Right, it does. And first, you know, when they're very little, it's going to be sharing their items, clothes that they've outgrown, toys that they no longer play with. And then as they get bigger, it's going to be a dollar or two of their money, either, you know, to church or to the Salvation Army kettle at Christmas time. We have quite a few friends that are serving overseas in other countries, and when they always come back to the States, we usually host a dinner, have them over for dinner, maybe some other of their friends, so they can all meet and greet and catch up with one another.
And our kids see that, and they participate. Another thing they do is they do community service projects. All three of our sons are Eagle Scouts, and logged in hundreds, if not thousands, of hours of community service. So it's not just giving money that we're talking about. It's a lifestyle of sharing, caring, being generous with your time, your possessions, and your money.
We're usually really involved in our kids' clubs. So we had one daughter involved in a 4-H club, and we helped set up a garage sale as a fundraiser. They went around collecting coins from neighbors for Coppers for Cooperation. Our kids were also involved in a nonprofit drama club, and so we did a silent auction at their performances. There's myriads of ways you can help right where your kids are to show them how to give back.
Let's take a phone call or two. This is Warren in Delray Beach. Hello, Warren. Thanks for your patience.
Thank you for taking my call, Joseph. There is much to be said for some of the basic principles or methods that your guests have put in their book and are discussing today. They're not getting into any of the exceptions. I don't know, you know, listening to this, on which planet they lived. But when I was a kid, when I say I was a kid, I'm talking about, you know, pre-20, my school regimen, both here and abroad, was so rigorous that there was rarely any time nor energy left to do things like having jobs, plus the fact that at least in those times and places, I can't think of too many people who would have hired someone my age or at my so-called experiential level. Certainly, I did some work in the family business, and Lord knows I carted more garbage out than the New York Department of Sanitation, I think. But School, as I said, was enormously rigorous. When it got up to college time, yes, my father paid for part of it, but a great deal of it I got on a scholarship incentive award. And then, of course, in the New York system in those days, if you went to City College of New York, you were there on scholarship. I mean, you paid $35 a semester.
Well, Warren, let's hear what the guests had to say here.
Okay, Joseph. Well, the first thing I would say today is a lot of the teenagers and the young adults are addicted to video games. And so my thinking is if they have time to spend hours playing video games, they have time to work. So, you know, I understand that it was rigorous back when Warren was a kid, but it isn't anymore. I mean, school has been dumbed down so much in the last 40 years. It is absolutely ridiculous. And for a kid to work a 10-hour-a-week part-time job is not going to affect their grades.
I had to walk 10 miles in the snow to school every day.
Oh, come on.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I was going to ask you that, Annette and Steve, how technology, computers, smartphones, and other various electronic devices belong in a money-smart family. Two aspects of that. One, if you allowed them, and because there's so much peer pressure to have all these things, how your kids got away from it if you didn't allow it.
That's a great question, Bonnie. Oh, my gosh. And we get that all the time. And we have a whole chapter on toys and technology and recreation. So basically, you're right. Technology was limited in our house. We have a computer in the office that is one computer that all the kids have to share. There's a laptop that they also can share. But TVs and VCRs and Blu-rays and DVDs and their own computer do not exist in our kids' bedroom.
We found a Kaiser family study that talked about the benefits of limiting screen time, and we quote the study extensively in the book, because they found that children under the age of 4 exposed to inordinate amounts of screen time didn't develop as well as children who weren't. So we're really calling parents to question whether technology is the answer or whether relationship and reading is the answer to helping kids grow up to be money smart. For instance, let's talk about cell phones, because a lot of families think that, well, actually a lot of children are telling their parents that it's a right of childhood to have a full data plan and unlimited texting.
And, you know, when they first started, the way they were sold to kids was, well, your kid needs to have a phone in case there's an emergency.
Right.
That's how they first got, that was the marketing campaign to get phones into everybody's hands.
But the Kaiser study revealed that kids spend more than 5 to 7 hours, I think it's a day, playing games on their phone and texting. So here's my question. If we're working to raise money smart kids and we're spending money on technology, shouldn't we look at it more as a business proposal and say, how is that tool that we're investing in helping our child to do his job? Is he getting better grades because of it? Is he able to be more productive at home and at work? And if the answer is no to any of those, then I'd say that technology is really a toy and not a tool. And we aren't helping our kids.
It's hurting them. It's actually hurting them.
So what we did in our house is we said, if you want a phone, you need to bear the full cost of it, and you need to pay for the monthly plan. And all of our kids have opted not to get them until they were in college. And they just didn't want to spend the money they were earning on that expense. And so we didn't provide the data plan. We had a family phone, a prepaid phone with T-Mobile, and it's, you know, it just worked.
And it's shared among all. Whoever, like, is out at night gets the family phone.
And they didn't get much peer pressure for not having phones? And
They learned, and their friends knew us.
Okay.
And they would borrow a friend's phone to make a phone call if they could. You know, and some people say, oh, that's mooching. No, you know what it was? It was them, our kids learning that there were limits in life, and there are always limits in life, and sometimes you have to ask for help.
And, you know, sometimes it is inconvenient, and it's a bother, but it's never been a huge issue. And like our son, who's at college right now, doesn't want a cell phone. He doesn't want to spend the money on the cell phone. So if people need to get a hold of him, he does have a tablet with internet. He says, email me. I check email several times a day. If you want to get a hold of me, email me.
That is amazing. I cannot imagine a college kid without a cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
You have extraordinary children.
Well, imagine this. Imagine a college kid without debt.
Well, that's another thing it's hard to imagine. Yes.
So it's a trade-off, but he's going to come out of school with positive cash flow. He's going to come out with a positive net worth, and he is. I keep telling him, Joe, I know this is hard, but you are going to be miles and miles and years ahead of your peers. We get emails from people saying, we've been married 20 years, both of us came out of college with student loans, and we just finished paying them off, and now our kids are ready to go to college.
Yeah, you hear that all the time.
What option do they have?
Let's go back to some listener calls. This is Joe in Coral Springs. Hey, Joe.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a lot like you guys. I prepare my kids as a financial analyst. I'm sort of reliving my financial life through them. In other words, my older kids have like IRAs, and I really have, you know, tried to establish similar values to what you're talking about. The question I have is, my financial advisor, what happened was, as I was growing up, we pretty much lived, I always thought we were poor. And, you know, I had a job since I was 11 years old. It built a lot of values. I had to work real hard. And those values built my success. And I transfer those values to my kids. But at what point do you want them to want for nothing? When my father passed away, my mom was very well off. And then I realized we weren't very poor. And I was like, oh, my gosh. I mean, you know, I didn't have to ride my bike to college every day. And my financial advisor told me, you know, don't really tell your kids how much money you have, because if they're thinking, you know, that you're rich, they kind of slack off.
Yes.
Versus,
yes,
you know, telling them that they're, you know, not as well off, to establish sort of like, you know, I don't know, hard
your
knock
parents
value.
Do you agree with that, Stephen?
Oh,
Annette?
Right on, Joe.
What did his parents give him? Okay, we just finished the Olympics a few months ago, and we saw some of the most phenomenal athletes, well-trained bodies, total control, disciplined, and we saw them out there perform great feats that if any of us tried, we'd probably fall into five pieces on the floor and writhe in pain. You know, how did those athletes get to that point of excellence? And I guarantee you it wasn't because their parents went to the gym and worked out for them. They didn't achieve success because their parents did the work. They achieved success because they did the work. And Joe, your parents gave you a gift by allowing you to do the heavy lifting, and as a result of that, you gained financial strength and wisdom that never would have occurred had they given you the money and had you not had to struggle. So it's not unkind. It is actually, it's loving, it's tough love. It's tough love that teaches our kids to stand on their own. And we agree, you shouldn't let your kids live at your income level. They may never attain that.
We have an emailer. It's Andrea in Pembroke Pines. She wants you to speak about the expenses of raising a child just in the first year of life. And she mentioned the money-saving benefits of breastfeeding and just wanted you to comment on that as opposed to buying formula.
Well, yeah, I can. It'll be a little bit, it may be controversial, but, you know, I stayed home with my babies and I did nurse them and I even used cloth diapers. So once we got to number five, I couldn't deal with cloth diapers anymore. There were so many kids and I had two in diapers at once and I was homeschooling and it was a little bit overwhelming. So number five ended up in disposables. But yes, you can save a ton of money the first year that your baby is born by breastfeeding and using cloth diapers.
And not only is it less expensive, but it's healthier because the children develop fewer food allergies.
Right.
They develop a tolerance to the foods that you eat.
Right.
There was one study. We actually had a ton of this information that we were going to put in the book. The book got so long we had to pull it out.
Right.
But we did an analysis of cloth diapers versus disposable diapers versus diaper services. And today, cloth diapers are made with Velcro on them. There's websites that...
Oh, yeah, tell you how to make them yourself.
Exactly. And they're way healthier for your children to wear. The same thing with breastfeeding versus formula. So I agree with Andrea that the first year can be expensive, but it doesn't have to be. And actually, even Joe said, you know, he started off poor. And having limited funds is not a reason for despair. It's actually a reason for creativity. And nothing stimulates creativity more than having a lack of money. And it's amazing the things you come up with when funds are tough and you're committed to living within your means and not going in debt.
Tell me, Do you ever get wild and indulge your kids in something where you have a soft spot, or
you know,
or is it pretty much regimented?
We do everything everybody else does. We have pizza nights. We go out for ice cream. We go bowling.
We were in Orlando and went to Disney World, and that was a great time.
I mean, we have wonderful family vacations. So we do everything everybody else does, and perhaps even more.
Somebody wrote about us, and they said they're living the American dream in a very un-American way, without debt, and it can be done.
So I guess you don't believe in credit cards at all.
I believe they exist.
You've heard about them.
I believe that people can live with credit cards and be smart with them, but I also know that credit card companies expect that you'll spend 25% more than a person spending cash would.
But to rent a car or get an airline ticket, it's kind of...
Use a debit card.
Okay.
And most airlines, actually all airlines now, and most rental car companies will rent with a debit card. They'll put a $200 hold on your account, but because we have money in the bank, it's not a problem. And we've done it in every city across the country.
You mentioned a few moments ago about how not having money made your children very creative. That was my one concern with so much focus on finances and money. How do children develop their intuition, their creativity, and their innate talents? That was,
Have you ever bought your child an expensive toy and they spend more time playing with the box than they do with the toy? Have you ever seen a child play with a bucket of water or a hose instead of the expensive toy you bought them? Giving our kids time away from technology and television, allowing them to read books. We read books out loud. The creativity. We have two kids that have written their own books.
Okay.
And
we also did the state fair every year.
Oh, this is fun.
This is when they were little, and we'd spend all summer crafting from glass etching and wood burning to rocketry to clay to, oh, we had so much fun.
And the kids made money by winning blue ribbon.
Our daughter made $100 by entering two different categories and multiple items in each category. And, of course, then we scheduled a field trip to go to the state fair and see all their ribbons. And so exciting, so much fun. I sure miss those days.
I don't think we were lacking for creativity one bit.
I guess not.
Let's take another call. We've got Dane in Deerfield Beach. Hey there.
Hey, I just wanted to share my little experience with moving out at 17 to avoid living under my parents' rules. You know, they wanted me to go to college and work full-time, and I had worked in high school, but I just didn't want to go to college, so I moved out on my own. I figured, well, if I have to work full-time, I can support myself and not have to listen to their rules. And it was actually the best thing I ever did for myself because at that point I really had no direction, no idea of what I wanted to do. But working a couple of years before college and then eventually enrolling myself and paying for it myself allowed me to kind of, through experience of working, know what I wanted to do, what kind of jobs I didn't want to do. It allowed me to think more seriously about what I was going to school for because I didn't just want to pick something just to, you know, have something to do while my parents paid for school because they weren't paying, I was paying. And my experience is that I use my degree every day. I'm totally happy with my choice. I love my job. It was in the field I chose. And all my friends that I know personally that went to school on their parents' money, I don't know a single one that uses their degree in the field that they went to school for. And mainly because they were too young, they just picked something that they could do pretty easily while they were up at school having fun and their parents were paying all the bills. So I believe totally in allowing your kids to kind of pay for their own things and allow them to learn on their own the value of money and the value of, you know, an education for themselves. And rather than being told they must do it and have someone else pay the bill, they don't really appreciate it, especially when you're only 17 getting out of high school.
Good for you, Dean. You know, each one of our kids is so different. So for us to say, I think you should be a doctor, is utterly ridiculous. Each one of them has different talents, different gifts, different skills, different personalities, and allowing them to struggle through trying to figure it out. We let them do a lot of different things in high school. At one point, our oldest daughter thought she wanted to be a vet. So we called up a vet's office near our home and said, can she volunteer there for 6 months? They said, sure. She ended up mopping floors and watching neuters and spays all day long and said, I don't want to be a vet.
And that's an incredibly valuable thing we talk about in the work chapter is allowing our kids to experience through internships, volunteerism, different fields of study so that by the time they do get to college, just like Dean did, he knew what he didn't want to do. That is so valuable.
Oh,
and,
gosh.
And I've got a question. I don't know if Dean's still on the line, but
yes, he is.
His relationship with his parents now that he's out on his own.
Well, actually, my relationship is great now, but at the time, it wasn't good. And for those first 2 years when I worked, put myself through, or, you know, lived on my own and didn't put myself through school, I really didn't speak to them very much. And it wasn't until I kind of came into my own and paid through everything myself, and, you know, I came out of school that I eventually reconnected with them, and now our relationship is very strong, especially with
his
mother.
That's awesome. They respect the fact that you did it and stood on your own. And I got to tell you, personally, when we decided to live on one income, my parents didn't like it. They didn't talk to us for a while, and they thought we were out to lunch. And when we had a baby 11 months later, they really thought we were out to lunch. And it took probably about 20 years for my dad to finally come to me, and when we paid off our second house, he said, "You guys are really doing it right and well. All of your brothers have borrowed money from me. You've never borrowed a dime."
Wow.
So standing independent does build your own esteem, build your own... It just builds strength, and people will notice, and it may not be right away, but that's an awesome story.
And it's a great feeling to have for yourself.
You mentioned before, earlier, very early in our conversation, about so many people you knew in their 50s that were still dependent on their parents. I just wondered if it's ever too late to become money smart. I mean, is this for people in their 50s as well as children?
Oh, that's a great question.
We have a chapter called Adult Children Bailouts, because this is, it's heartbreaking. We're seeing widows, retired, whose children are coming and basically taking everything out of their houses. It is so wrong. It is so wrong. And we have sample contracts in there where if an adult child wants to move back home, we've given you a couple options for how to structure it with defined limits and defined duties, because we want to empower adult parents to not make it easy, not enable those children, but push them to independence.
And in the bailout chapter, we talk about how, you know, depending on how much you are supporting them right now, you don't want to just cut the cord one day and call it cold turkey, because if they're relying on you for everything, there's got to be a process. But you need to work toward closing that spigot of financial drain.
We were talking with a TV host, one of the best interviewers we ever did, and this man was wealthy, and he could afford to send all four of his children to a private school in California. But what he did was he said, the first year I'll pay 100% of your college education. The second year, I'll pay 75%. The third year, I'll pay 50%.
Folks, we have to be going. How about a website where people can learn more about you and the book?
Sure. They can go to americascheapestfamily.com. We run specials all the time there.
Or join us on Facebook at facebook.com/americascheapestfamily.
Well, thanks very much.
It's been great being with you.
Yeah, it has.
And the book is called The Money Smart Family System, Teaching Financial Independence to Children of Every Age. Thank you.
And we thank you for joining us. Of course, Joseph Cooper is still recovering. That was a rebroadcast today. He's recovering from his back injury. He's doing much better. We thank you for spending your time with us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction and production assistance from our online producer, Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents, and you can follow me on Twitter at Bonnie Berman. Tomorrow's Topical Currents begins with information about the upcoming traveling Smithsonian exhibition at History Miami, American Sabor, Latinos in U.S. Popular Music. The exhibition, exploring the influence of Latin music and culture on American pop culture, opens soon, and we'll visit with Ramiro Ortiz, president and CEO. And more, Linda Gassenheimer speaks with Tim Andriola from the new Basil Park restaurant on Sunny Isles. Bonnie Berman thanking you for joining us, hoping your day is a great one. And please stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.